We've now got Steve. I'm tempted to say, who is also a Quaker. I think this is a Quaker conference, actually. Am I at the right one? But wonderful, wonderful, the contribution of the Quakers. And Steve has worked. He's a practitioner at local level and national level for the Quakers, running non-violence training programs, one called Turning the Tide, working for practical action for the future. And he wants to conduct this session as a kind of a workshop, to give us something practical to go away with so that we can act differently when we leave here in our communities, in our parishes and in our neighbourhoods. Steve has worked on this for a long time at grassroots level with environmental groups, community groups, social justice activists. Give him a really warm welcome as he addresses us now.
Thank you, John, and thank you for coming back. It's really good to see you after such an intensive morning and early afternoon. And thank you to the Justice and Peace Network for inviting me. So John said a bit about me. I started off as a kind of, most of us are, getting angry and annoyed about things that I wanted to change and becoming what has been described as an activist. And that led me to be employed by the Quakers. And the biggest bit of my work was that program, Turning the Tide, which initially was peace-focused, starting working in very practical ways and action-based ways, working with peace groups, local and then national. So some of the national projects, and this is going back some years that you may have heard about, was we designed and ran the non-violence training programs for a project called Trident Ploughshares, which was focused on stopping, disabling, obstructing the Trident nuclear weapons system. And then that led us to be invited to work with the early climate camps, the forerunners, I guess, of what is Extinction Rebellion today. So some pretty radical sort of actions, but always with a non-violence ethos. So part of the work was to try and get a shared understanding of what we mean by non-violence. It's not just not hitting someone. And then onto Occupy and projects like that, but not just that. Most of it was with small groups, small community groups like animal welfare groups who are concerned about the treatment of animals, intentional communities that wanted to live a different way in community and to try and embed a culture, and housing cooperatives and so on and so on and so on. And after a while, we got invited to work overseas in many different places in Europe and a project in South Asia and a big project in East Africa. So we learned that people found the work valuable and useful. We've heard a lot about the problems, and we kind of know what the problems are, don't we? And this is the what can we do about it session, okay? So I'll talk for a bit just to kind of put some content in and some outline, but then I'd like you to do a bit of work because that's how I'm used to working. I not do very much work, but I get you to do the work. Because I firmly believe the solutions to the problems we wrestle with are within us. And we can bring those out. So where do I start? I always get a problem with these things of knowing where to start. I like to go to the root of things. So my favourite place to go to the root of what words mean and where they come from is a website called Etymology Online, and this is what it says. Politics comes from the Latin politicus, of citizens of the state. And that itself comes from the earlier Greek politis, citizen, and polis, city. So cities, citizens, it's about people and governance. And just, Well, we've already heard it's got two meanings, and we love those more than one meaning titles. So just is from Latin justus, which is upright, equitable, righteous in the eyes of God. And so I looked up, well, what does righteous mean then? Mm-hmm. Tracking back. And curiously, that comes from Old English. Ritwis, also meaning just, upright, conforming to divine law. And the second meaning of just politics is, we've heard, just politics. It's merely, simply, I think the kind of bridge word there is pure, purely politics. It's just politics. But that purely, merely, simply suggests that the basic principles are really not that difficult. So let's try something. Who here, put your hand up, if you've ever, in your life, as a child, adult, whatever, fed the ducks. Yeah, I have too. Yeah, as a kid and as an adult. So, you know, when you feed ducks, the big assertive ones come to the front, right? And the smaller, weaker ones, they tend to hang back. So now, put your hand up. If the only ducks you feed are those big greedy ones at the front. There you go. So there you go. That's what we have, the humanity we have in common. You know, when we feed the ducks, we try to throw beyond the greedy ones at the front. Oh, there's a little one there, can't get a look in. And the big one's taking it off them. So, you know, it's starting on the, you know, I'm lost. It's naturally, it's a God-given way of being, this equitable that was in that definition of the word justice, this righteous, it's sharing, it's in us. So, why is our politics not like this? It's about power, of course. When we feed the ducks, we are the ones with the power. We have the resources and choose how and to whom we distribute them. And we want to share it equitably. And of course, that's what we expect our governments to do for us, who elect them. We want them to share the nation's wealth equitably. Problem is that we humans are also like the ducks, aren't we, really? So I want to show you a diagram. Before we put it up, I was shown it, and I've never forgotten it. It's a diagram that I was shown when I was working in the office of a partner organisation I was working with in Bhopal, India. Does that name Bhopal ring any bells with anybody? So Bhopal was the site of, I think it's still the biggest industrial disaster ever. And that was in 1984, when an American chemical company, Union Carbide, its factory blew up. It was producing insecticides or pesticides. Killed tens of thousands of people. And there was worldwide uproar, and Union Carbide pulled out, but they were pestered and bullied, I suppose, to pay some compensation. They reluctantly did, not enough, not nearly enough, and they didn't do the clear-up. They got taken over by a Dow chemical company, which is still going. And I raise this because neither government in India or the US felt able or willing to enforce proper compensation. So that plant is still there when I was there. And people, and the poisons, the toxins have gone into the water course, and people are still getting sick, deformed babies, getting sick, ill, dying. So, Jerry, could we have the first slide, please? So this is the diagram I saw. Just a Venn diagram. You've got civil society, that's us, right, on the one hand. You've got business on the other. And the government is in the middle. There's overlap between the two. We elect the government. We elect the government. We give it our taxes to govern society and ensure our societal needs are met. And we want it to practice just politics and deliver a just society. So that's the deal with democracy, right? But then we have business, which we're also stakeholders in, and they produce the goods and services that society needs or wants. But their primary objective is not normally to create a just society. Their purpose is to generate profit. And if it's not profitable, they're not interested. That's their reason for being. So this sets up a tension, doesn't it? Corporations tend not to be democratic in their culture. Mostly they have power structures for often very good operational reasons that are rigidly top-down and dominating. That's the sort of power. And they have different needs to society. They have different ways of operating. A lot of us are in voluntary groups. We operate democratically. We are used to that. That's our culture. But for the large corporations, which have got larger and larger and gone global, their paramount objective is to make a profit for shareholders. In fact, it's a legal requirement. They have to do it. So what I think has been happening over recent decades, actually, is government has moved further towards a business type of model, a business cultural model. I like to call it a corporocracy we're moving towards, government by corporations, with politicians increasingly serving the interests of global corporations ahead of their civil societies, and believing that they can square that circle by getting or inducing the corporations to provide and meet societal needs. So they try to straddle those two needs, but they're pulling in different directions. And business has been pulling harder. So they take the profits and our taxes cover their losses. And we mop up afterwards. So in Bhopal, they're still doing the mopping up without the expertise. So many politicians, and I don't know about the new intake, and I hope to be encouraged by the new intake, but many of our previous politicians have come from that corporate culture and continue whilst in Parliament to act as industry consultants. And after they stop being MPs, many walk into lucrative positions with large corporations, bringing their network of contacts with them. So it can be a close and mutually rewarding relationship for both parties. Consequently, I think what's happening is that democratic structures and processes that are core to a healthy civil society are being eroded and diminished. Here's a quote from Pope Francis, who's getting a lot of quotes this weekend from everyone. Politics is noble. It is one of the highest forms of charity, as Paul VI used to say. We sully it when we mix it with business. Political power can be corrupted if common good is not the only converging point. Common good has to be the converging point, and it has to be the only converging point. I learned from reading Gandhi that power is not a possession. It's not something you give and keep hold of. It's actually a relationship. One person has power because others allow it. And as citizens, we give our power by voting to those who represent us. It's a transfer of power. And this election, we kind of pulled it back and said we want it to go a different way. So power has a dynamic that can be changed. It's a relationship. We can change relationships. And much of my work has been about exploring different types of power, different power structures and processes with groups that want to make a change in that power dynamic. How do we change the power and empower ourselves to pull it back to justice? People in every faith tradition understand that we should do unto others as we would have them do unto us. And that's the basis of a moral framework for our lives as individuals, as families, as small groups, as nations. It's in all cultures. And Molly this morning quoted a much-loved Quaker advice, which is the core one for me. So I'm going to repeat it because it's the thing that I cling to. Take heed, dear friends, to the promptings of love and truth in your hearts, for these are the leadings of God. And for me, that's the essence of my faith. Listen to my inner promptings of love and truth and act on them faithfully. Always testing, of course, to see if I might be mistaken. And that's where coming in and having these dialogues is really necessary and vital. But that desire, that inner God-given impulse to act out of love and do good deeds leads us to some wonderful actions. You know, I've just been into the other hall there to look at all the amazing work that's being done just within this small gathering, relatively small gathering. You know, we do amazing things, helping those in distress, volunteering at food banks and charity shops, joining good neighbour schemes, being a good neighbour, offering space to refugees, donating, you know it, because you do it. All of this helps alleviate suffering. But how often do we examine what is causing this suffering? What are the politics and the powers behind it? So I'm going to tell a story now. You may have heard it, but I think it's an important one. There's a village. It's not true, by the way, just in case you get concerned, but it's an illustrative story. There's a village picnic. Let's call it a church picnic. Everyone goes a big gathering on the village green by a river. And everyone puts the food out and starts to the picnic. And someone near the river cries out and shouts, "There's a baby in the river. It's floating down. There's no one around." So they wade in, get the baby out. And they try to care for it, dry it, and it's still fine. And someone says, "There's another one." And so people, and then there's another one. And so soon the whole picnic is focused on rescuing babies from the river. But three or four of that group ask themselves, well, where are they coming from? Who's doing this? So they go upriver. And my work in nonviolence has been about going upriver, working with people who want to say, how can I stop this? So, how do we change the power that causes injustice? And how do we do it nonviolently? I need to say right out that taking heed of love and truth in our hearts, the leadings of God, inevitably brings us into conflict with the world as it is. So non-violence means doing that conflict differently. And that's a different conference. Maybe that's next year. You know, if we're going upriver, we need to be clear that we'll be confronting those who think it's a good idea to throw babies in the water. But in doing so, we confront it by not becoming the thing we oppose, by not mirroring the behaviour. We do it differently. We do conflict differently. To me, that's the essence of nonviolence. Jesus told his disciples, who I like to think of as early activists, he said, "I'm sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." And doing this work non-violently means we act from our hearts, out of love and respect for everyone, including our opponent. But we also need to use our heads and be wise as serpents. So we need to assess the situation, look at the big picture, and then break it down, because we can be overwhelmed by these vast problems. What can I do about it? How often have we heard that? Oh, well, there's nothing we can do, is there? We need to analyse the strengths and weaknesses of our opponent and where their power comes from. Where's the source of their power? And then analyse ourselves to explore how we can build our own power, how we can empower ourselves. And then act, and then evaluate, and then plan again. And then act, and then evaluate, and then plan again. And remember, we can't do everything. We can't change the world by next Tuesday, but we can be effective in really small ways. And always knowing that other individuals and small groups everywhere are doing similar things, because that is the prompting of love and truth in everyone. What we can do is create the conditions for change. So I'm suggesting that analysis is essential for engagement with the powers that be. So, of course, we're saying no to the injustice, but we also need to be clear about what we're saying yes to. It's always more effective when we're challenging things to frame what we're doing in terms of the positive thing we're for and not the negative thing we're against. Yes to this future, yes to this future means no to this present, this unjust present. So, for example, if we want to take action against the privatisation of the NHS, how about that? That's huge. How can we do that? I think maybe we just break it down and look at what is the thing that is of most concern to us on that question, privatising the NHS. How does that impact on me and my life locally? So we might focus on our local dentist. And I'm raising that because where I live, there's no NHS dentists. And we have to go 100 miles because we're still registered with the NHS dentist that we used to live in, the town we used to live. So that's where we go. And there's a lot of agitation and concern about it and people not knowing what they can do. So our campaign then will be for our local dentist accepting NHS patients or more NHS patients, rather than against them being totally private and expensive. And there are loads and loads of tools for analysis out there to help with all of this. But for now, I just want to share two of the top favourites that groups I've worked with find particularly effective. Right, this one's called Pillars of Power, and it's an upturned triangle. So for a start, that's not natural, is it? Triangles don't, you know, pyramids, they don't actually stand on their points. That goes against natural law, right? Really, they should be supported by the base. The only way they can sustain being upturned. So basically, in this one, we put the problem, the injustice there. It goes against our natural way of looking at things. It can only be sustained in that position by using props to prop it up. So what you do is you just put as many props in you like and you just say, well, what's the reasons behind this? And the way of breaking it down is that you can just take one of those props and make another triangle out of it and have what's propping that bit of it up. So if we go to the next slide, Jerry, please. So if we take the dentist idea, I can't remember what I put up there now. These are things off the top of my head, really, just to illustrate. So private dentists are replacing NHS dentists. Why? Well, the government has withdrawn funding, or a lot of the funding, from NHS dentists. And there are a lot of private health corporations wanting some of that. So they come in and they've been offered contracts, and the government, who works closely with them, is fine, you can provide that social requirement, that social need. Higher pay for private dentists, who's going to turn down a pay rise? And what's that last one? Yes, a lot of the big companies who provide for their employees private medical health, they will provide private dental care. So that's part of the package of being employed by that corporation. So that's just one example. So if we then take that one prop, the withdrawal of funding, can we go to the next one? That's breaking it down. So we make another problem out of the withdrawal of funding. What's propping that up? Is there anything we can do about that? And I've put here, because it seems clear to me, that part of the prop is the ideology of the government that public is bad, private is good. So it has to be privately provided. And, of course, they've been lobbied very strongly by a lot of the private health corporations. And there is a perception that the government has more important things to do than to address this problem. You know, there is a provision, let's get on with it, but we've got other more pressing issues to do. And this mantra from the government that there is a lack of funds for these things. I always find it curious that, you know, when it's a social need, there's a lack of funds. But when a government wants to do something, the money's suddenly found. Magically, the magic money tree. So let's go to the next social. Can we go to the next one? Yes, this is called the social speedometer. And it's like a car speedo. It's a mapping out. So the first one was about where the sources of power are from. Now, the second one is about, well, how does that map out in terms of people who might support our point of view and people who might disagree with us? What are we up against and who's with us, if you like? Who can we work with? So it's a question of just mapping that out. And okay, there's some obvious allies on the left-hand side at 0 miles an hour for what we want to do. They're going nowhere. Is the very unsympathetic ones who are against what we want to do. You need to try at the top, which I haven't done, is to put the focus, the positive thing we're for. And then there's the unsympathetic ones, not as hostile, but not convinced. And then there's the neutral ones, who have not really thought about it, maybe, or are pretty unconcerned. And then we get onto the speeding version, the 50, 60 miles an hour, the sympathetic, and the 100 miles an hour, they're the ones really with us. So can we go to the next slide? So what I've put there is private dental companies, the sorts of ones that we've looked at in the previous one. They're not going to be very sympathetic, but we do have to engage with them. And so that confrontation is about opening the space for that engagement. Others who may not be sympathetic are private dentists, some dental students who are coming into the profession, some politicians. And then the neutral, the dentists that are still trying to manage both, trying to cater for both needs and provide both services, some politicians, you've got some politicians all through the spectrum, I think, some customers of dentists, and locally connected celebrities. And I put that in because when you're planning, or when we're planning to do something and to take action and to shift that power dynamic, often a local celebrity who you can get on side, who speaks public and people think well of, that can shift things. Okay, and sometimes, and that's the celebrity culture, isn't it? Sometimes it just takes one of those people to get people to question it and to think, oh, yeah, maybe they're right. And then on the allies side, NHS dentists still trying to do the work. The public, I think a lot of the public, if not most of us, would like us to go back to how things were. And some politicians who want that to happen as well. The Professional Association for Dentists, interestingly, is also against the privatisation of it. And they have, that's the body that engaged strongly with Parliament and business. So that's the mapping. And they're just tools to play with, but once you get into that way of thinking, it can actually, little ideas and little moments can occur. We could do that. We could approach, some of our local dentists and just have a chat with them and just understand why they're doing what they're doing or not. And I'm offering these tools because, as I said, they've been really, really helpful. For example, I did a big project in East Africa, and there was one group that we worked with. They were motorcycle taxis. They were all young men, and they have to be licensed, and they have to pay a lot for the license. And the licensing issuing authorities were basically ripping them off. They were corrupt. They'd write the ticket out, take the money, write the ticket out, and it was in the days when you had carbon paper, right? So they had the carbon paper upside down, and so the receipt that they kept, the issuing officer, just never appeared, and the money was never paid in. And so they got stopped, the riders, the taxi drivers, and they were told they were acting illegally. Here's our ticket. Well, we can't find any trace of it back at the office. So the first time we were brought in because their previous protests were pretty violent because that was what they knew how to do, disruption. But ultimately, we got them to act together and to set up a dialogue with the people, expose the corruption, go to the governor and prepare. What they did is they used these tools. They looked at the sources of power. They said, who's actually too corrupt for us to, we're not going to get their ear, really, because they're in on it. Anyway, long story short, they won. And they changed the system so that there were checks and verifications all over. Another, I could go on, but another one I just want to tell you about. There was a school, a Chinese mining company were dynamiting in a quarry, and it destroyed the school outbuildings and the toilet block. And the school authorities, they drew attention to this. They drew the state governor's attention to it. Nothing, because they were like that with the mining company. So we got them to use these tools and to create a dialogue. But the key to the dialogue is showing that you have enough in your camp, as it were, enough power for them to listen to you. If you're not worth listening to, it's not in their interest to listen to you, then they won't. So it's about trying to build that power. And finally, school children in Canada. Oh, sorry, that was a success story too. They got compensation. They got the company to rebuild the toilet block. All was well for the time being. School children in Canada wanting organic, fair-traded lunches. And the school didn't listen to them. And that was another success story. So anyway, that's just to say that they're not the only things, but they're the ones that have been really quite valuable for a lot of groups who actually want to get together and try and make a change in the small ways that we can. So I want you to do the next bit of work. Can we put the next slide up, Jerry? So there's the two diagrams. What you need is a pen and paper, pencil. This won't work on smartphones. It needs to be pen and paper so you can scribble and draw. And getting to groups of twos, threes, wherever, maybe someone you don't know so well. But the key thing is identify between you one issue that you'd like to change and that you know something about, so that you can actually start on that analysis. So you don't all need to agree, but just one person in that group needs to say, okay, how about doing this, okay? And just pick one of those, and if you've got time, do two of them, but just try working with those tools, and just let's see what happens. Are you up for that? Great. And if you need any clarification or if you need me to come over and just have a chat, then please put your hand up and I'll come round. Does that sound okay? And what time do we?
About 10 past.
Yeah. It'd be good to get some feedback from this to see if they've been useful for you, yeah?
So it's about 5 past then.
Okay. Okay, make that 5 past, but we'll see. We'll call it from here to when to wrap up and report back. Okay, is everybody clear?